Hello and welcome back to the Tread Lightly podcast. Happy New Year and thank you to everyone who listened in 2023. We are excited to have you join us in 2024. And if you're new to listening, thank you. We have a really exciting episode on tap. I am Laura of Laura Norris Running.
And I am co-host and coach Amanda Brooks of Run to the Finish. And yes, I'm going to bring you an extra gravelly voice for this episode because why wouldn't we kick off the year that way?
'Tis the season.
Yes. Okay. We have one of your questions to kick us off. So this is from Instagram, Callie J. Mans. How do you hydrate properly without always having to go to the bathroom during a race?
That's a great question because I know many people do have to stop for the bathroom in a race in a marathon. And it's really unpleasant if you have that experience. So often what I advise athletes is to start thinking about being well hydrated for a marathon a long, long time before the marathon actually starts. This is something you should be thinking about the day before your race, race week, staying well hydrated the morning of. Usually what I recommend to athletes is like when you get up and you have your pre-race meal, have 16 to 20 ounces of sport drink. You want some sodium in there to help your body hold on to this fluid in the cells, not just pass it right out. So the sodium can help not have to go to the bathroom during the race. And then often I suggest to my athletes stop drinking large amounts of water about 1 hour before the race. If you've hydrated well the day before, the week leading up, and the morning of, you shouldn't need anything in that final hour. And it kind of gives you time to like empty your bladder, not feel like you have to go during the race. What would you recommend?
Those are really, really good tips. I think one thing I would add to that, and we probably talked about it in a previous episode, is bladder training, basically. So getting used to not going to the bathroom repeatedly all day long. I think, especially when I worked in an office, it was like an excuse to get away from my desk. I would go to the bathroom. And so then every hour you were going to the bathroom. But realistically, we can train our bladder to hold fluid for a lot longer. And this doesn't mean you should like make yourself be in pain, but that way you're also not waking up in the middle of the night. My husband and I talked about this recently. So I was like, yeah, you're drinking more water and you're going pee constantly all day. And he was like, I never thought about that. So that would be like a secondary tip outside of what you're doing right around the race.
Yeah. And you know, I think it's always like if you have to pee, stop sooner than later because it just gets worse and worse if you go. But there's no real such thing. Like I hear some people like, oh, I don't want to break the seal once I go pee. It's going to make me keep going pee. There's no evidence for that. So if you have to go, go get it out of the way and you'll probably feel better the rest of the race. Speaking of races, though, that brings us to today's topic, which are the upcoming Olympic marathon qualifying trials.
I'm so excited about this. I've been to watch a few of the previous marathon trials, and there's just so much happening in person and so much excitement, and just watching those elites out there like putting their heart on the line. It's really, really inspiring.
It's so cool. I've never been to it in person, but I love watching it on TV. There was one year we had guests visiting and I made them all sit and watch it with me because I was not going to miss it. And they were like, people take marathons this seriously? Yes, it's an Olympic sport.
Yeah, for sure. So we've got some really fun facts for you and maybe some information you didn't know, some different things. So let's start with talking a little bit about the course. So I got to go down to Orlando and actually preview the course. And while I was there, in fact, a number of the qualifiers came in town and got to run a preview themselves. So they had a full motorcade blocking the road. And that was pretty awesome. You could see them with their phones out sort of recording like the finish so they could go home and visualize, which was really cool. So if you don't know, February 3rd, 10 a.m. Eastern in Orlando is the marathon trials course for both the men and the women. The way they've set it up is really spectator friendly. So it all starts downtown near Lake Eola. So this is about 45 minutes from Disney. So if you've been to Orlando before, it is not the same area. Very pretty, a very downtown area. maybe 15 minutes from the airport, so super easy to access if you're flying in. The course will start with one loop that's 2.2 miles, so short, and then from there they turn onto the longer loop, which is 8 miles, and they're going to do that 3 times. As a spectator, obviously, if you're on that outer loop, it gives you a chance to see them all go by 3 times, which is super exciting. The finish is right at Lake Eola. So if you're trying to get down there, expect that it's going to be a madhouse because that's where everyone's trying to get. And I can tell you in Atlanta, we started out a ways from the finish line so we could see them go by multiple times. And then we ran over to there and it was probably 10 people deep. So actually seeing the runners became nearly impossible. So you're almost better off if you're willing to like spread yourself out somewhere. And right there on Lake Eola, you'll see Fifth Third Bank. And that is where the actual finish line will be. Also near there is where NBC is going to set up. So if you want to see Kara Goucher, as far as we know right now, that'll be the area she should be broadcasting from. On that loop that's 8 miles, it's Orlando. So, I mean, it is flat for the most part, but I would say it has just some like baby bumps to it. There's no real hills, but just little inclines, little declines. I kept saying things were flat in the race last week, and I had people who disagreed with me. So I think it's just when you are running a 5 minute pace, you notice every incline and every decline. So I think for these elites though, it may actually feel good because they're going to just slightly change muscles a little bit. And you know, they know how to manage their energy. So I don't expect it'll be anything crazy. They've also modified what the original course was to take out any of the roads that have pavers, which was personally my initial concern. So the race we did was, I don't know, at least a third of it, if not more, was on pavers. And that was my expectation for where they're running. So they did a great job finding a way to create a course where that wouldn't be underfoot for them.
Sounds like they put a lot of thought into the course creation. And I know, though, that there was some controversy surrounding not the course itself, but the start time. I'm sure if you follow US marathoning, US track and field closely, you probably heard of this, but originally the start time was at noon. And even though it's February, noon in the Orlando area in February can be quite hot, quite humid, and a lot of these athletes are not heat acclimated. They're not coming from summer training like you would have at, say, Chicago. They're coming from winter training. And obviously elites have resources to heat acclimate, but there was concern about the dangerous conditions and about how it could impact the teams we send to the marathon. When people qualify at the Olympic trials, now it's not just that they need to place in the top three, they also need to meet standard times set forth by the International Olympic Committee. And right now, we only have 2 men who have met those times. So it's hinging on the trials to get a third man to meet that time. Eventually, though, due to letters written by many top athletes, including Jared Ward, I believe, the start time is now, like Amanda said, at 10 a.m. Most people will be done by noon, a little bit safer in the heat, and hopefully leading to better performances and, you know, maybe getting 3 men on our Olympic team this time.
Yeah, talking with the team from Orlando Track Shack, who is really managing everything, creating the course, I mean, I heard some laughable quotes like, never in all our years of putting on races have we said, hey, you know what would be better for the athletes is if we start later in the day. So they were sort of getting the heat for it, but I think many of us don't realize just how stringent the standards are and the requirements that come down from the governing body of the Olympics. And so it really was a back and forth. And then they had to get NBC to agree to change a time that they already had in their calendar. So I think everyone's definitely excited. We're going to see that 10 a.m. start. And like you mentioned, I think this is a really interesting piece on the qualification that not everyone is sort of aware of. So for qualifying to get to the Olympic trials, for men, it was a 2:18 marathon or a 1:03 half. And they roughly have 2 years to get the marathon time and more like a year to get that half time. And on the women's side, it's a 2:37 marathon or a 1:12 half. So that is the U.S. Olympic trials standard, which is not the same, like you said, as the Olympic standard. So again, women 2:37, but the Olympic standard is 2:29:30. We actually have a ton of women under that number. So it means the top three are absolutely 100% who we're sending to the Olympics, unless someone has to drop. For the men, again, it was a 2:18, but the Olympic standard is a 2:08:10. And like you said, we only have two people who have currently hit that. And it doesn't mean we won't end up sending three people. We'll know that better by like January 31st. It comes down to basically a bunch of logistics around other countries and how many people they've had qualify and things like that. But ideally, if we could get another man under that time, then we would be guaranteed our three spots.
Yes. And the reason we have these new Olympic standards in place is, like you said, they're trying to limit the number of athletes who are actually participating in the Olympic marathon in Paris this year. Because in, I believe it was in Rio, and they just had so many people out there, and it was almost too large of a field for the type of sport. Hence why they're trying to narrow it down now.
Which is actually a similar reason that they dropped the women's standard this year. So it was 2:45 and now it's 2:37. And that means we have way, way, way less women who are into the trials this time. And so there's kind of arguments on both sides of that. And the one side is saying, like, listen, these larger fields create a lot of issues, like getting their bottles on time, being able to have access to those tables. We saw this for people just running the Berlin Marathon last year. They offered a service so that you could utilize it, and people ended up with no nutrition. So larger fields create that problem. The host city suddenly is paying for way more than they expected. And then, like we just talked about, potentially having someone win who doesn't have a qualifying time, and then they're getting this prize purse but aren't actually representing us, and it becomes very confusing.
Now, there are 227 men who have reached qualifying times to compete at Orlando, and 173 women. The qualifying windows are now closed off, but Allison Wade, whose newsletter Fast Women is definitely something you should subscribe to, pointed out that women rose to the occasion of this more stringent qualifying time. In the last trials in 2020, just 82 women had run under 2:37. This time around, it's that full 173 have all run under 2:37. Sorry. So women met those standards. Like, it, maybe that's not what the people wanted when they changed it, but we rose to the occasion.
Yeah, I think one of the other points they brought up that was interesting in Fast Women was that the easier standard actually keeps more women in the sport. So it gives them the opportunity to train with others. It gives them the hope. And that hope is often enough to just keep you showing up, to just keep pushing. And that, as a result, tends to make everyone faster. So I think it'll be interesting to see if there's another drop prior to the next one.
So then, kind of one thing you did hint at is that one of the reasons they try to limit the field is because the host city covers the costs for these athletes. All air travel, lodging, meals for qualified athletes, and USATF management are covered by the host city. And one thing I didn't really think about ever before we started researching this episode are the financial costs of the host city. It's actually quite high, way higher than I thought. So kind of an idea of what's going behind the scenes. This is from a report put together on Let's Run. The costs are so high that in the past, cities have lost $500,000 to $1 million. They spent, you know, $2.3 million, didn't make that up fully in revenue. That's because $100,000 has to be paid to USATF just to let the city host. It's expected to put in a minimum of $75,000 for advertising. The city must provide a competitive prize purse, usually a minimum of $600,000, split amongst the podium athletes. They have to pay for security, insurance, equipment, timing mats, police, signage, drug testing, etc. And they are heavily limited, the host city is, in the sponsors that they can accept. So USATF owns the rights to broadcasting. There cannot be conflicting sponsors that conflict with anything USATF has. So like no car sponsors other than Toyota. And it puts the host cities sometimes in a pinch. And I think we began to see this with this trials because there was fewer cities competing to host the 2024 Olympic marathon trials.
Yeah, I think oftentimes we don't really look at who's paying for what, and it just seems like the Olympic governing body probably has a lot of money, but they are, yeah, pushing it off. And it was very interesting being down in Orlando, and of course, brands are all sponsoring different runners, and you know they've got their team that's made the trials, so they want to be there and show support. But anywhere along the course, basically, you will not see a single banner that says whatever, Nike or Puma or anything like that, because it is not allowed and it is strictly enforced with all kinds of fines. They have all sorts of things around like the specific size. Any logo can even be on their jerseys. And in fact, this applies to pretty much any race where they are running as an elite. And if it's the wrong size, they'll just make them put like tape over it. So can you imagine like you're running in the Olympics and you've got duct tape on you? That's probably not what you're aiming for. Yeah, so it is a very interesting thing where the host city is obviously bringing in revenue from people coming in, but downtown Orlando is also a little bit limited. It's not a massive area by any means. And so like the number of people they can even get in there to try and make all that up. Yeah, very tough.
It is. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it's free to go spectate, correct?
Yep. Spectators, you can be anywhere you want on the course. And so yeah, there's no like way for them to recoup that other than if you're eating at a restaurant or staying at a hotel.
And all athletes have free entry. And I know that some coaches, such as Coach Ben Rosario of the North Arizona Elite, they coach like Steph Bruce, Scott, or no, he left the team. He coaches Steph Bruce and some other athletes, posed a few different solutions a few years back, doing something like the Marathon Project was, selling tickets instead of having free spectators. Maybe having a sliding scale of how much athletes pay based on their finishing times. But it'll be interesting to see how this business model continues in the future if cities are going to keep accepting it as is, knowing they lose money, especially in this post-pandemic economy. Or, you know, maybe cities will be like, hey, I can think of creative ways around all of this to make some money.
For sure. And then also just on the athlete side of things, the amount it costs them to go to races and travel and train and all those kinds of things. Wazelle started their Underbird program this year, which I thought was really interesting. They basically had five women who they were supporting in their quest to get on the team. I know four of them made it. I am not sure about the fifth one because that was recent. But for them, that meant they were helping out with a lot of those expenses, because that's something I think a lot of us sort of forget about, too, for these elites, is that most of the time that stuff is not always covered unless a race happened to invite them. And, you know, they're not racing a crazy amount to win a ton of purses or anything like that. And I keep saying purses because that's the term everyone uses, but prize money is just the way to think of that.
So then I guess like kind of at this point, thinking of the elite athletes, do you have any favorites for making the Olympic team or speculations about the outcome? I know in 2020, everyone was surprised, but what are your thoughts?
I know this one's kind of interesting because we've got such variety out there, I feel like, from age to experience, but we have a lot of women who have really crushed that Olympic standard already. I mean, personally, I would be really excited if Kira D'Amato made it. I feel like she's just a great person anyways, not that all of them aren't. But I think she would be exciting. Molly Seidel is an interesting one. She's definitely a contender. Like, she's got the mental side and she's willing to just lay it all out, which is really what it's going to take on the day, you know? I think Alphine would have been a big pick for me, but she's been dealing with an injury. So I don't know what she'll kind of look like by February. What about you?
Yeah, I don't know, because there's a few people on this list dealing with injury. Like, if it had been a few months ago, I would have said Emma Bates, but I know she's been dealing with an injury. She was in a boot after Chicago. She finished that with pretty bad injury, and I don't know, based on social media, what her training's like, but prior to that, I would have said Emma Bates. Emily Sisson, I think, is a pretty obvious one. She's fast. She rises to meet the challenges set in front of her, and then Kira DeMoto. Like you said, I think she's one of our best athletes, and she has done so remarkably well as she has, like, she entered the sport professionally late, but it's so cool to see someone who's not the typical age that we think of these athletes to be managing kids and quote unquote older in the scheme of athletics and totally crushing it. Like, I'm really rooting for her.
Yeah. There's a number of other names that I think will be really familiar to everyone. Sarah Vaughn, Lindsay Flanagan, Nell Rojas, Sarah Sellers. Des Linden. So Stephanie Bruce, really and truly on the women's side, I feel like it'll be an exciting race because so many of us have been watching a lot of these women for a while. And people will kind of have favorites, whereas I feel like the men's side is a little different. It feels like a lot of newer, more recent names.
Yeah, so the two men who have the Olympic standard are Connor Mance and Clayton Young, who up until this year I had not heard of. They're, I both believe, younger. Both, I believe, based in Utah and Mormon, which means that their training is actually a bit different than we've seen a lot before for male athletes. They take a rest day each week, kind of like Jarrett Ward did. It's interesting to me that the two men at the top take their rest days very seriously. Maybe there's some lesson to be gleaned there. Galen Rupp is so close. He's within, like, less than 40 seconds, but it will all have to depend on the trials. But then other favorites, like, I know I've always enjoyed following Scott Fobel. He trains right by my husband's work, so sometimes we'll see them on Team Boss out and about. He's pretty darn close also. It'll just kind of have to depend how the day looks. What do you think of the men's side?
Yeah, I do think it's really interesting. Obviously, Jarrett Ward is in here again, and I kind of have heard some different chatter where folks are like, man, I don't know if he's kind of got that final kick in him because he needs to drop almost 3 minutes to kind of get down to that Olympic standard. But I think you never know what happens or what they're going to bring on that day. It's a different energy. It's a different moment that you've been working for so long. And like you said, Atlanta surprised us with who we thought would go and then who ended up being able to pull it out. And that could come down to what the weather does. February in Orlando, I know from having lived there, could be 40 degrees, could be 60 degrees. Like, it's variable, you know, as we all know with these races we keep signing up for that should have good weather and then turn out hot. So I feel like that'll really play into it, I think, a lot.
I think so too. And like, the one thing I've been looking at also is where they qualified for, because like with Atlanta was a hilly course. It required being able to race really well on hills and being very strategic. Orlando, like you said, is for all intents and purposes flat. And when we look at some of these people, like, I feel like the people who qualified at Chicago or Berlin are probably going to have a really good time on that course because it's such a similar course to what they've clearly raced well in on the past before. So that's, again, Jarrett Ward was at Berlin this past year. Emily Sisson and Kira DeMoto were both on flatter courses. So it's going to be interesting to see if there's a distinct difference from Atlanta based on the course profile.
For sure. I think one of the other interesting things, I was talking with Neely, Grace, and Kira when they were doing the course preview and kind of seeing like, what are people's plans around prior to the race? Like, are you coming down early? Are you not coming down early? And it was very split among the athletes who were there. Some were like, I want to be at home in my routine for as long as possible. And so they're going to kind of watch the weather. And if the weather seems like it's heating up, they'll come down early. Otherwise, they want to be as at home as long as possible. Others were like, nope, we've already planned it out. We're going to be here a month early, you know, and they're going to be acclimated. They're going to have run the course multiple more times. So again, they're just, visualization is huge for these athletes. They are really, really good at it. And I think that's something a lot of us take for granted is they do spend time really thinking about that goal. And so being able to run the course and know the turns and in your mind playing over like, here's what I'm going to do at this point, here's what I'm going to do at that point, can be really beneficial.
It can, yeah. It's just all really exciting to think about. Also, on a side note, I wish more marathons for us normal runners used loops. It sounds like it's such an advantage to be familiar with what's coming by the end. Any concluding thoughts on the Olympic trials in February?
One, I will say I'm the opposite. I am glad they are not loops. I think mentally loops for me are very hard. Like, can I just stop now? I've already passed the finish three times. Another quick note would just be for those of you who are really excited about track and field, that qualifying is actually June 21st through 30th in Eugene. So it is separate from the marathon trials entirely. Eugene kind of owns track and field, it feels like. So yeah, that'll be in June. And I have to admit, I was thinking about this earlier, like track and field feels like their races are always so hot. I am watching people run the 10K and it's like 3 p.m. and it's 80 degrees. And yet I've never heard them like push back on it. Granted, like it's obviously shorter than the marathon, but I don't know why. I was thinking about that earlier today.
Yeah, I know there were some concerns, I think in one year, I forget if it's the Olympics or Worlds or something, where they were pushing around times due to high heat. But it just amazes me that it's like these athletes can go and race in the heat and it be 3 p.m. and they've had a full day of eating, theoretically, and just grind it out. So hopefully this episode has been interesting. Yeah, they're all amazing and good. Like, I don't think any elites would be listening, but if anyone is, best of luck in Orlando. Everyone who is lining up is just amazing and we're all cheering for you.
100%. And I still want to like run a lap as a regular person so you can just watch how quickly they pull away. I think that would be the most amusing part of any Olympics because it becomes so easy watching them to not realize how phenomenal it is that they are running a 5.5 minute pace and just like they look so smooth and so relaxed. It's very easy to forget they are working so, so hard to do that.
They are. I mean, they're finishing these marathons in the time that most runners are thrilled to finish a half marathon, to put it in perspective. I forget the average half marathon times, but they're kind of in line with what these people are running for a full marathon.
Yes, exactly. So again, I'll just echo what Laura said. I hope that was interesting. I hope you will all plan to watch it. I know, like I said, I will be there. I will definitely be doing some group runs. So hit me up if you know you're going to be there and I'll make sure you're at all the things. But in the meantime, please make sure you take a second to rate, review, and subscribe. It really does mean so much to us and ensures that other runners can find the show and get great tips.
Yes, and you can reach out to us at Tread Lightly Running on Instagram. We love to hear from you. Thank you for listening.